Welcome to Shattering Myths. We were waiting for Yada to come in. It doesn't sound like he's he is on the line, but we'll go ahead and get started. How are you doing tonight, JP?
I can't complain. Like I said earlier, this is, aside from the festival, is one of my favorite days of the year because it's the longest possible time until I have to deal with Christmas again.
Yeah, there's an upside there. I was kind of making fun there in the chat room. Your wife had actually got on a post that I did on FB. John Kerry is literally claiming that the Bible tells America to protect Muslims from global warming. Amazing stuff. I don't know where they get that stuff. I think it's right there in the verse.
Yeah, that, just kind of pull it out of thin air.
Well, I think it's in the passage next to the one that tells us that America should force Israel to give up land to the Muslims. You know, it's in there somewhere. We'll just have to diligently search it out.
Well, it does say America will force Israel to give up land, but then it says that we're going to suffer the consequences of that choice.
Yeah, I think it says woe. I think that's the word you, woe. You know, and it's pretty bad news all the way around. I guess tonight, until Yada gets in, or maybe he's not getting in, I'm just going to go over some of the notes that I've been doing lately and putting out on FB. One of them, I'm going to start here with Dabarim, Deuteronomy 18:20 words. And, you know, this is a pretty big warning. I think this warning, it's specific to us to stay away from religious-sounding people and people that use religious terminology, certainly writings that use religious terminology. And this is what it says. It says, surely, however, the prophet who arrogantly rebels, showing no respect, exaggerates and is presumptuous, seething in their conceit. Well, that sounds like it's aimed right at Paul. While communicating a message in association with my name that I have not eternally inspired and completely directed him to say, and who continually writes and speaks in the names and renown of other different gods than that prophet, he himself actually will want to die. And, you know, when we see words like, you know, charity and grace, you know, which is charis and gratia, we know, and Paul, who goes on continually about those, it's pretty clear that that's aimed at us not to read his material. What would you say to that, JP?
Yeah, that seems, that's how I take it. That's one of the reasons they rejected Paul. Yeah, the whole Deuteronomy 18 test, Paul fails every single step of it, so.
Yeah, but I mean, talk about hit the nail on the head.
Every other religious leader.
Well, yeah.
God gave us this test for a reason. Yeah, I've used this when talking with people. I'm like, you know, my argument to people that have had this with religious friends is, take a Christian. Me and any Christian out there would agree that Joseph Smith did not speak for God. We would agree that Muhammad did not speak for God. Where we differ is on Paul. So my question to them is always, what criteria do you use to determine who speaks for God and who doesn't? And then, I point out my criteria is right here, Deuteronomy chapter 18, and I'll read it to them verse for verse, and show how each, you have the six steps or criteria. And then I'll be like, now, that is the test I use. What test do you use? And theirs essentially comes down to, is it in the Bible?
That's it? Somebody put it in a book? So if you took a book and you put a bunch of quotes from P.T. Barnum in there as an example, and as long as it was a accepted religious canon.
As long as you have a church saying that that's the word of God.
That's it. Okay. Yeah.
Yep.
Wow.
Once you get pastors to tell us that is 100% the inerrant word of God.
I had a guy today on a post, and it was the post that shows in Chabawook where Yahweh is clearly saying that he's talking about a guy named Sheol that will mislead many different people from many different races and places, and he's going to create this broad path, and he associates that path with the plague of death. He says he's going to be around during the fulfillment of the Moed Mikra, and we know that Paul was in rabbi school then. He talks about him being proud and puffed up. He talks about him being homosexual, which totally fits all Paul's writings. And I had a guy jump in and say, let's play a math game. How many books did Paul write? So I guess he's using the same things. I said, books? I said, you mean letters? He goes, don't play games with me. You know, answer me, how many? Like I said, you know, P.T. Barnum could be in any number of books that somebody decides to put in religious material and claim that material is the word of God, but it doesn't make it so, does it? You know, I mean, that's just bizarre.
So, I wrote 13 books. If I write 14, does that make my word more accurate than Paul's? I just have to write 14 letters?
Yeah.
That's all I got to do?
And talk about yourself.
I can hammer that out over a weekend.
you become a pretty important man when it comes down to infamy. You'd be the other man of infamy. It'd be pretty funny. I think we have a caller on the line there.
Well, if you just take numbers, you take questioning Paul versus... I'm not seeing anyone on the switchboard.
Really? From a 734? 734 area code?
I'm not. Maybe not. I just see you and me on here.
Oh, okay. Well, good enough then. Yeah,
you know, if you were just go by page numbers, questioning Paul is about three times longer than all of Paul's letters combined. Does that make Craig a prophet speaking for God?
No, but he uses Yahweh's words to prove Paul's a liar.
Yeah.
That works. The book does speak for God. Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. He doesn't speak for God. He just speaks God's words as God gave them to him.
Yeah, he just shares Yahweh's words. And since Yahweh's words are in that book, you know, it isn't Craig doing anything as much as it is just, you know, Yahweh's words tearing him apart. I thought that was a rather funny post. And then the guy, he kept saying over and over, go away in the name of Jesus. I told the boob, I was kicking him off the page. See, I won, he said. It's on my page saying that, right? Yeah, yeah. It's like a spammer, you know. Of course you're going to get rid of a spammer.
The power of Christ.
Yeah, it was really, I felt really threatened and so forth. It was really humorous. I mean, the guy, he kept calling me a hypocrite. I mean, what's hypocritical about me following Yahweh's words? And when another man opposes those words, I oppose that man. What's wrong with that? I mean, that's not hypocritical at all. What's hypocritical is to say that, yes, I believe in God, and I believe that, of course, his God is Paul, but, you know, I believe that Jesus was the Savior, and then, you know, all the things that even the caricature Jesus said, this guy says in opposition to. So, I mean, his God isn't even the make-believe Jesus. It's just simply Paul, which is another name that was made up because his real name was Sheol. I mean, I think everything these people believe is made up. I mean, it's kind of ironic.
Well, at least Paul made that name up for himself.
Yeah. Well, he says God did it. Right? Doesn't he say that Yahusha renamed him? Didn't he say that?
No. Does he? I don't recall that.
I could
be wrong.
I think that that's where he. I could be wrong.
Probably.
It doesn't matter
to be like
either way.
Israel.
Yeah, Right.
He's probably trying to put himself on par with Israel.
He's like Yaakov.
Yeah, God gave him a
nickname. Yeah, sure.
Or Shimon.
Yeah, of course, that was just a nickname when he was calling him Jesse.
Desperately
want to
be that way.
Yeah, that's, I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
That's probably what he was doing there. I didn't even think about that. I want to go over a verse that in Hosea, in Hosea 2:16-17. You know, there's a lot said in this verse, and there's a lot of reasons for the verse. And what it says is, and it shall be in that specific day, prophetically declares Yahweh, you shall encounter and welcome me as an individual. And you shall not call me my Lord ever again, for I will take accordingly the Lord's names out of her mouth, and they shall not be remembered, recalled, mentioned by their name ever again. So these Lord's names are going to be taken away out of the mouths of everybody for all time because he hates it so badly. And he wants, you know, it's not just the fact being called Lord, is Baal's moniker. It associates him with all the things one would associate with the Lord. Or with a religious deity. Have you ever noticed, JB, that most religious deities out there, they got people kneeling to them, or they're threatening them, or they're throwing lightning bolts at them, or maybe they're even just bowling them over like rolling pins arbitrarily. Have you ever noticed that? You know, the Greek gods and all these different gods.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
they're very Lord-like. You know, it's one of the things I've had a conversation with several people on is, yeah, they get that. Well, it doesn't matter if I don't know his name exactly. You know, he knows my heart. Say he does know you, but the very fact that you call him Lord tells me you don't know him. You know, the idea that you can know God, his character, and who he is without knowing his name, I would agree with because, you know, I used to call him Yahweh, and I think I still knew him then. I've come to know him better, but I still knew him. But if you call him Lord, you don't know anything about his character because it's the exact opposite of his character. You know, being the Lord is the exact opposite of what God wants. So if you think that's a title he desires, you don't know him.
Yeah, so yeah, it goes well beyond the fact that it's Baal's moniker. It changes the whole nature of who Yahweh is. The fact he exists out time, he's not manipulating,
yeah,
he's not standing over people. You know, he's not a micromanager in control. I mean, all these religious concepts get thrown into this Lord business. And, you know, they can do all the copy edits they want. They can say, you won't call me Bali when it actually says Balaam, or Bali. You know, they can say all this all they want, but in the bottom line is, in the final analysis, he wants to be welcomed as an individual. Now, that is a big statement. Welcomed as an individual. That is a real relationship. You don't have that kind of relationship with a religious deity.
Y'all's words are great in that. No.
No, go ahead.
Y'all's words are great in that, you know, the way he uses them are all about explaining them. And the fact that he says it starts off, you know, this whole condemnation of Baal and the Lord by saying he wants to be welcomed as an individual makes it where you cannot say, oh, well, what he's talking about is just this or just that. No, he's speaking of the connotations that come with the title Lord. He wants to be an individual, a person that we talk to, we come to, you know, we have an intimate personal relationship, not a Lord.
That's exactly right. I mean, it's laughable to me. It's like calling Shamar Obey, right? Or it's calling Torah law. Or it's calling Mitzvah command. You know, and they even say command where the word Mitzvah doesn't even exist. I mean, they just threw a command in there a number of times. You know.
There's a lot of times you'll see just the word Kara, which means spoke, and they'll say, oh, no, that's commanded. And,
yeah.
You know, there's nothing in the connotation.
Like when he's talking to Abraham. talking to Abraham and commanding him to come out of Babylon.
Yeah.
Which is an outrageous concept because, I mean, we've been through this, but trying to take a person and command them into an honest relationship is somewhere near insanity. It's certainly twisted. It's socially retarded at best. Right? I mean, I'm going to command you to be friends with me. I mean, what does that mean exactly? You know,
that's no basis for a relationship.
Yeah, I know. It's just a bizarre concept. You know, we'd went over the Mizmor 119:45, where Dode's saying, "And I choose to walk in its freedom," speaking of the Torah, "because indeed I have sought after, inquired about, found, and have looked to your precepts and directions." Now, precepts and directions, pekudim, is a whole different concept than a bunch of, you know, I obeyed laws.
Yeah.
I found freedom in obeying laws. I mean, it's a bizarre concept
when it comes to scripture. Yeah. And, you know, context is king in everything when it comes to scripture. And the context in which Yahweh uses all of these words is in a way that the religious connotation is impossible to come to. You know, the context dictates the, you know, how you should translate a word. And these religious connotations don't exist in the context. You know, in the context of choice, commands don't exist.
Yeah, they can't exist. In a relational sense, they can't exist. And that's how Yahweh clearly states that people are going to know him. He says it in Zechariah. They're going to know him in a relational sense. You know, I know one thing. If I went to your home, you know, and I walked in and you were commanding me around, I'd never go back. You know, I couldn't deal with anybody doing that. You know, I have a hard time believing.
You don't want to come into my house when I'm cooking.
Well, okay. At least stay out of the kitchen, you mean? Yeah, that's another issue, you know. I don't like to get in people's way either, but it's one of those things where, you know, there are glaring examples that jump out. And the biggest fight we have, and I've said this before, and I'll say it again, the biggest fight we have is trying to reach into the core of Yahweh's words and put them out there in a way that people begin to understand that this is a relational thing that Yahweh's looking for. He's not looking for wind-up dolls. You know, if Yahweh would have wanted to create us on our knees, you know, and have us prostrate ourselves three times a day, he could do that. He could have done that. There are animals that even look like that.
Wait,
praying mantis, as they say. You know, go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say, this reminds me a lot of when me and Patty were first dating, we came from very different views. I was very agnostic in coming to know Yah at the time. She was Christian in coming to know Yah. But one of the things that I noticed was Christians say a lot of things that are 100% accurate. They just don't act upon those. You know, Christians say that, you know, God wants a relationship, that Christianity is a relationship with God, but they don't act like that. They don't act like that he's a God that wants a relationship. They act like he's a Lord. You know, Christians, you know, they say a lot of things that in and of themselves are 100% accurate. They just don't follow them to their logical conclusion, which would make them, you know, if they followed what they said to their logical conclusion, they would leave their religion. And that was kind of part of what brought Patty around was, you know, realizing that and following these things that she had been taught by her parents, but following them to the logical conclusion and realizing that it contradicted everything else that the religion was teaching.
You know, he paints a real broad brush too, right? That real broad stroke in this passage here again in words in 18:9. Do, you know, Dabarim. Indeed, when you come into and are come into the land associated with Yahweh, your God, has given to you, you shall not accept, teach, or imitate, or engage in any of the disgusting religious ways of these Gentile nations. Now, there was a whole group of Gentile nations that Yahweh had, you know, wiped off the face of the earth. You know, there were like six of them. I mean, you know, he had them destroyed. And he said not even to...
It was one of the few times where God ordered violence.
There was about a 70-year period of time in a 3,500-year history that Yahweh actually supported the notion of war.
And it was against a very limited group of city-states. Yeah, it wasn't wide open, just go kill anyone who doesn't agree with you. It was the specific city-states that existed within the land he wanted to give them. And, you know, if they'd have listened to him and actually followed through with that, things would have been much better off for them and us today.
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, you know, Yad had pointed out that almost... You know, the moment that they crossed into the land, I mean, even really prior to that, before they got to the land, I say almost, almost the moment they left Egypt, they started falling away. I mean, just almost immediately, right? I mean, they went out and built themselves a cab right away.
Yeah, Stephen,
you know, so they could
worship
it.
Just asked why Yah didn't just use the... why God didn't just use the Moloch to wipe out those nations? And I would say it was a way to teach the Israelites a lesson. He wanted them to God existing outside of time again, knew that they would not follow through with what he said, and he wanted them to see the consequences of that. And the consequences were that they became corrupted as a nation because they allowed some of these people to live within them. Yeah, you know, he was teaching them a lesson, and he taught us a lesson through them. You know, that's really what, you know, this idea of the Jews as God's chosen people. You know, the idea of being chosen, people tend to think, oh, that's a good thing. Really, it means they were chosen to be an example to the world, and that's both good and bad, because, you know, God uses your mistakes to show the world what's wrong, and God uses what you do right to show the world what's right. It's up to you to do the right thing most of the time. A lot of pressure for
that. It's absolutely true. And I want to look at some of the names. Now, these are the names of the people that Yahweh had wiped out, okay? Jericho, which is really Yarakal, meaning of the moon. Yarakal of the moon is what it means, of the moon. So the people of the moon, he had them wiped out. Then a group, their name is, I guess, pronounced I. Because it's An Yod in the Hebrew text, and it means heap of ruins. Okay, so these are people who are just going to turn everything into a heap of ruins. Yeah, those would be great neighbors to have. Then we got Gibbon, which conveys the
idea. Doesn't that sound a lot like Muslims to you?
Yeah, it does to me. I mean, I'm just saying. You know,
how much better would the world have been if they had took out the Muslims back then?
Yeah, I mean, we're, you know, these are the religious connotations. I mean, these obviously these people carry some pretty heavy connotations with them. Gibbon, which is it means like an adulterous hill, an evil and an idolatrous hill, rather. Then we got Chebron, meaning associated with the occult. Okay. We've got, it's almost like Dabar. It's Dabra, I guess. D-A-B-Y-R, which means to fear and revere the word. Yeah. I'm not sure what that is, but maybe they were the wrong words. And then a group, Hazor, which is written actually Katsor, meaning protected an enclosure or castle. So I guess these people just built themselves up like little stumbling, demented child kings or something.
Sounds like self-reliant so people.
Yeah, yeah. There's something going on with that one. You know, sort of the king of the hill type of people. And those were the people, you know, those are just some of the names of the groups he had wiped out. And so, you know, you sit down and you look at those things. And, you know, one of the big things that really kind of lights me up is when I've heard people say, claim that the God of the covenant writings, of course they call it Old Testament, is a lot like the God that's in the Quran. Well, the fact is that, you know, if you look at relationship and nurturing versus harsh or immoral verses, that, you know, in Yahweh's words, the nurturing went out at 500 to 1. And in the Quran, it's less than 1 in 50. So they're actually 25,000 times more
different. Completely ignorant of both scripture, both the Torah and the Quran. You have to be to make that comment.
Right, right. But you do hear it. You do.
Oh, yeah,
you do
hear
it. You do see it. You know, it's usually on, you know, when people are about as deep as, say, Bill Maher or somebody like that. I mean, you know, it's somebody who,
yeah,
who really, it's almost like a cliched response or something like that. But, yeah, I mean, there's not well-thought-out
people. That, you know, argue that, yeah, well, the Torah tells them to kill these people, and the Quran tells them to kill people, so the Torah and the Quran are the same. You know, never mind, you know, again, like we pointed out, it's in a very specific period of time and a very specific group of people versus everyone else in the world.
Well, no, exactly. I mean, it's just, it's very, very bizarre. Honey was pointing out to me that one of the things that you get in a relational sense, and this is going back to where we started, is if you're going to know anybody in any relational way, you're going to call them by their name. You know, so by calling them a Lord,
exactly,
and twisting their nature, it's a bizarre concept. You know, if you and I say we work together every day, and I came in a very serious manner, not in a joking manner, but in a very serious manner, and I called you Lord JB, and if anybody asked me anything, you know, I would with great reverence say, you know, almost with fierce, you must ask Lord JB. You know, at some point, that would get a little tired to you, wouldn't it?
No.
I mean, you have to be saying...
I feel the first time. I hated when I was doing my student teaching and being called Mr. Bowen.
Yeah, forget Lord Bowen.
Lord, I'm feeling real uncomfortable.
God, these are really bizarre religious concepts. You know, and the more we kick this can down the street, I know the more bizarre that it really gets. Is Yada on the phone now?
I am.
Yeah, I was going to say, I got a caller on there. I didn't know who it was.
Step up to the plate.
I've been listening. I've been listening. I've been impressed. I was out doing my primary job where I am known by my first name. I'm actually called by my first name other than my son actually calls me Dad, which is you know, quite appropriate, but I was out being a dad and husband and with my family on a long drive, and we just got back a few minutes ago. So normally you'd apologize for not showing up on time. I knew you guys would do a great job and fill in, and realistically, what is our primary job here on earth? To be husbands, fathers, mothers, wives, brothers, sisters. It's all about family. And I was out spending a really good time with mine. But you know what you guys were talking about, this idea that that the God of the of all religions is the same, and it doesn't matter what you call him. Universally, that is stated by people who don't know who God is, and therefore they're conveying what is a very popular opinion about a God that they do not know. And if they were to ever actually back up and think about it, if there is actually a God, then the God that actually exists would be irritated by being called a name other than the name that he chose for himself, and the God who actually exists would be excruciatingly irritated with having traits and characteristics applied to him that are the antithesis of what he stands for, wants, and represents. And so rather than this the possibility of one God by many names and many characteristics and many religions, if you actually backed up and said, okay, if there's a God that was capable of creating the universe and of establishing DNA and RNA and the complex nature of life, that God is not going to find it cute that we call him names that he did not choose and that we apply characteristics to him that are, quite frankly, demeaning.
Well, not just that. Now, let's step back a little further. Now he's a religious deity that created the universe that wants to be worshipped, and you're calling him by this other name.
Right.
Whoa. Yeah. Whoa. You're about to get your, you know, ass handed to you.
Yeah, the very concept of a God that would create a being to worship him is disgusting. A God who would be so insecure, so egotistical even, that he or she would create a being for the express purpose of telling them how wonderful they are and being subjected to them and fearing them describes a monster. Why can't people recognize that? It's and yet that's the religious reality, is their gods are actually monsters. In fact, even an all-loving God is a monster. I know, and I'm amazed that people can't figure this out. And all you have to do is apply what I was just doing. And I was out with my family. And where we were going, because people are on holiday, you know, there were large crowds. And there are some people that were acting stupidly. And, you know, my response to the people that were acting stupidly when I'm shepherding my family through these crowds and wasn't, oh, well, aren't they cute? Don't you just love the belligerent drunkard there that has no respect for anyone else's life? Aren't they just adorable? No.
Yeah,
this all-loving, all-accepting God is a doofus. I mean, it's a monster. It's someone who doesn't care enough to want to protect his children. That's what it represents.
It's not a God that is lovable.
Right.
You know, an all-loving God is not lovable.
Yeah. In fact, we were our drive on the way back, the last conversation was about DNA and RNA and the fact that there are actually languages, that it wasn't until about 10 years ago that mankind was able to map one human's DNA for the very first time, one of 7 billion humans, and they were able to map it, not explain it, but just map it for the first time. And we were talking about the chromosomes and the DNA and this sort of thing, and there are 22 chromosomes plus a sex chromosome. And, you know, 22 just happens to be the number of letters in the Hebrew alphabet. And you know, you look at DNA and you look at RNA that translates DNA. The DNA is kind of like a database. The RNA is like the conduit that communicates or translates the DNA database into something that can be is useful, and then the proteins that are established by the RNA is the program that the that life runs on, and the only way that we're even able to fathom any of this at this point is because of supercomputers. It takes a supercomputer just to process the information so that we can examine what exists. We can't use the supercomputer to create any of this. We have no idea how it's created. We have no idea how to rewire it. But we can use a supercomputer to at least read the program. And you
break the surface of understanding.
Right, for the purpose of trying to understand what was created, how this, you know, for the first time actually being able to read the book. And you then think about the complexity of all of that and this language that exists as a database, the conduit, the broadband or USB port of the RNA that ports it to a place where it can be applied, and the proteins then acting as the program. And then you say, all right, the entity that designed that wants to be the beneficiaries to get down on their knees and tell him how wonderful he is. I mean, don't you think he knows?
Yeah.
I think
he knows who he is. I don't even think he needs the ego stroke. You know,
it would be absurd to have someone that you created with this vastly complex language and program tell you how wonderful you are. It would be like, creating a stick man, you know, out of popsicle sticks, and then having that popsicle man hold up a sign and says, "My creator is the best creator there ever was," and me feeling good about it.
Yeah, it might be a good joke, you know, or a prank or whatever to put on your desk.
Yeah,
but it certainly wouldn't be anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole concept. Popsicle stick man, I'm going to take it to a relationship for all eternity.
Yeah, popsicle man, yeah. Now what I need to do is empower my popsicle man, perfect my popsicle man, make my popsicle man alive, give it free will, give it a conscience where it can be judgmental, and then I want to spend all of my eternity with my popsicle man, because, boy, just think of all the fun stuff that popsicle man and I could do.
You can even pre-program him to say all kinds of wonderful things.
Oh, yeah. Could you imagine programming your popsicle man to please you?
Be amazing,
I mean,
wouldn't it?
You know, you're almost now talking about the guys creating analog sex dolls that they can have an imaginary relationship with, and you're saying, boy, isn't that fulfilling? My life is so enriched because I've got this blow-up doll that has a tape recorder that says, "Oh, you are really wonderful."
Yeah, it'd just be lovely, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah.
It'd be one fulfilling relationship.
Yeah, I guess it'd be even better if you get the blow-up doll to bow to you 100 times a day and tell you how wonderful you are.
It's a bizarre situation too, because I've always said, you know, when I see these things, "Oh, I praise you and love you, oh my dear Lord," you know, I see these things, you know, they go by on FB, and you know, you see people actually posting things like this, and it's like they've all done their best to take a stab at writing a Hallmark greeting card. I mean, it's really bad stuff. There's never anything deeper than, "Oh, my Lord, I cannot live without you." And nonsense. I mean, they're even poorly written Hallmark cards most of the time.
Yeah.
They wouldn't even meet that standard. I mean, it's really bad.
Yeah. And it's really no different than having an imaginary friend. Yeah, you might as well be saying, "Harvey, my imaginary friend. I couldn't live without my imaginary friend." What's the difference between a God that is conceived by humankind and an imaginary friend? I mean, just because the Christian God, the Lord Jesus Christ, is a God that is an imaginary friend that is shared with billions of people, doesn't make the imaginary friend any more real. You know,
a million people can get together and make an imaginary friend, and it doesn't make that imaginary friend any more real.
Correct.
He's still imaginary.
Right. You know, I could take my stick man and have my stick man do magic tricks on a YouTube video so that you see the stick man run and you see the stick man create fire and you see the stick man jump up and down. And we could have millions of people view stick man and have stick man say that I am the creator god of the universe, and I can prove it by breathing fire. And you could have people believe that stick man is God. Doesn't make it so.
Stick man. Yeah, you know, this is a pretty good concept. You could probably build a whole movie around this character.
Yeah, we want to have a wager to whether or not movie. That collectively we could create a religion. Maybe we could be like L. Ron Hubbard in Scientology. Want to bet?
Create a religion on a bet.
Yeah.
I don't think I can do that with a good conscience.
Yeah, we could have the principal holiday be Festivus because it's already pretty popular in the culture. You know, the festival for the rest of us. Why not? I mean, it'd be fairly easy to do. I mean, all it would cost us is our souls.
Yeah, oh yeah, gee, that'd be a nice trade-off.
That's a bit too high of a cost for me.
Yeah, a little. Well, our souls and our relationship with Yahweh, so I think we'll pass on doing it, but it's a it would be a fairly easy thing to do. Or we could spend the same amount of time studying Yahweh's testimony, closely examine, carefully consider what he had to say, benefit from that, and share it with others. I mean, that's the other option. I personally think
that
the other option
is... That sounds like a much better investment of my time.
Absolutely. So here
it's like getting an Apple stock tip back in the late 70s.
Yeah, buy that.
Were you listening earlier? John Kerry actually came out and said that the Bible commands America to protect Muslims from global warming.
Yeah, no, I read that as a news article. He gave a speech. The speech is about 6 weeks old. Yeah, and he gave a speech that where he said that the Bible demands that we protect Muslims from global warming.
Global warming.
Yeah, and I read his statements, and the article was picked up in major news periodicals. I don't know if I actually presented on Shattering Myths, because, you know, when I do the show, I'll each day I pick like 10, 12 news articles, but I put them in front of those that I picked the previous day, and I only get through about half, you know, that I picked the previous day, and so I end up with a 1,000-page document of news stories. And so, you know, 3/4 of the news stories that I read, I actually don't report on because I just don't get to them. But I remember reading the story where John Kerry talked about how there's a biblical mandate for us, particularly to protect Muslims from global warming. And you're reading this stuff and saying, "Oh my God!" And it could be imagined being the journalist. And you're not having the smarts to figure out that this man is absolutely a loony tune.
And no, I can't imagine being that stupid personally. But wow, you know, it does say something about the press corps, doesn't it?
Oh, you know, the ability to influence the earth. I mean, in the sense that we till the ground, and it speaks of us being tilling the ground. It talks of us, you know, picking weeds and of being productive, producing that which is nourishing from the ground, and toiling and providing for ourselves and others through this process. And it talks about how we would go about choosing and preparing the kinds of animals that we would eat, because we are protein dependent as an animal. But there is no word in Hebrew that would translate to environment. There's no word in Hebrew that would translate as to climate. There is certainly no edict in Hebrew about global warming or climate change or carbon dioxide emissions or any of this kind of stuff, and the only references to Muslims is to demean the religion. So, John Kerry would be an absolute nincompoop. So, JB, I think, is just written a message here to me. We're ready to change subjects, and he said that he has a question that somebody wanted to ask on the air tonight. Go ahead, JB, and then we'll turn to the psalm.
All right, I wasn't trying to change the subject. I just wanted, before we convert to go over to something else,
I'm aware of John Kerry's statement. It is one of a thousand reasons that we ought to write him and the government off as deceivers. They lack credibility, so what they're attempting to do is usurp the credibility of God to support their twisted agenda.
Wait a minute. You're saying he's not credible? Are you going that far?
Yeah, John Kerry is not credible. John Kerry is an enemy of God. He's an enemy of Israel. He is an enemy of mankind in general, and he is a complete and utter deceiving fraud. And the only individual in the U.S. government now that I would rank worse than him would be the man he works for, the Abominator, and the man that he ran against in the first election, John McClown. I would say those might well be the most miserable three people in the U.S. government. So what's your question?
You're supposed to get rid of all three of them.
Yeah. But the problem is, it's like Saddam Hussein. You get rid of a weasel in a country that is dominated by weasels, and what are you going to get?
Another weasel.
More weasels.
Yeah, that's all there is to it.
They're the three stooges.
Yeah, if you were to eliminate one of the stooges, so then you have two stooges. So why
is that much different?
Right. You want to tell me that King George I was better than King George II, or that King George II was better than Bill Clinton, or that Bill Clinton was better than Al Gore, or that Al Gore was better than Jimmy Carter, or that Jimmy Carter was better than the idiot we have now, the Abominator? I mean,
Ford.
Yeah, or Ford. I mean, which one of these morons do you think was a upstanding, honorable, productive, positive influence on the country?
Well, you know, 10 years ago, I would have said Reagan, but nowadays I can't even say that.
No, you know, there was a myth amongst conservatives that Reagan was a good guy because, you know, he rode tall in the saddle, he looked good in a white hat, and
he said good things.
Yeah, and he said some good things, but the fact of the matter is he bankrupted the country with his military buildup. He while his supply side economics was a grand and productive idea, his military spending obfuscated the benefits, and he didn't do anything to rein in the size of government. So.
He grew government. In addition to growing government, he increased taxes because
Reagan was
the guy that increased all the Social Security taxes.
Yeah, that was
the people he hurt the worst were the poor.
Yeah, the myth is that Reagan was a conservative. That's the myth. And he had conservative rhetoric, but their behavior is all the same.
I bought into that myth once upon a time.
Yeah, I did too. Yeah, I was a Reaganite, and then I came to realize that. No, Reagan was a fraud. They're all frauds. You know, Woodrow Wilson, Truman, FDR, LBJ. I mean, they're all horrible. Even the guys that we built shrines to, Lincoln, Washington, were scumbags.
But JB, what was the question?
Lincoln was a turnaround.
Yeah, Lincoln was the ultimate racist. He was opposed to the U.S. Constitution, and he was a racist. The myth of Lincoln bears no resemblance whatsoever to the actual man and the damage he did to the country.
Well, he was a strange-looking guy.
Yeah, learning about the real Lincoln was one of the most eye-opening experiences of my life. Because
yeah,
I had been raised that Lincoln was this great president, and but when you really look at it, and that guy was one of the worst.
He was really scum. Yeah, he was scum. In the Lincoln-Douglas debates, he wanted blacks to be isolated. He didn't want any more slave states because he didn't want blacks integrated with whites. He wanted to put blacks into concentration camps. Yeah, he was a guy that states that freely joined the Union were not allowed to freely leave the Union, and so he imposed a war that cost 650,000 American lives, all to force the compliance with a union. It was a horrible decision.
And started us down the path that led to this massive federal government
right.
that was never intended by the Constitution. We would not be where we are today if it were not for Lincoln.
Yeah, Lincoln was a disaster constitutionally for America. He was also the first to essentially print money to cause America to have a fiat experience with currency, and completely ignored the Constitution in his prosecution of that war. Horrible individual. And the only guy that you could actually say had some redeeming qualities as president would be Thomas Jefferson. And the more you come to know Thomas Jefferson, you know, he's a pretty decent guy, bright guy, pretty decent guy. He had some issues. I mean, he kind of had dote issues. He was doing one of his slaves, and he had lots of personal demons, but nonetheless, the man certainly understood the consequence and the horrible nature of religion. He had Paul figured out long before most people did, and wrote about Paul being a complete fraud, contradicting Yosha. You know, he understood many of the...
On a balance scale, Thomas Jefferson is slightly in the good.
Yes, yeah.
He was the smartest in the bunch, too. I mean, there's no question in my mind. I mean,
he was the smartest.
Woodrow Wilson might have had his PhD, but he wasn't very bright.
Yeah, well, Woodrow
you know,
Wilson
like
would have been one of the biggest
food.
Measles in the bunch. Anyway, what's your question, JB? Your friend's question.
Terry had asked me the other day. It was based on a thread that they had on Facebook, but the
so
question
this is Terry as in Kirk White?
T. Haston. He's in the chat room right now.
Oh, okay. All right.
But it was related to Yao Kanan's use of the word cherus in Yao Kanan 1, and that it's found in the earliest manuscripts. And he said that in Questioning Paul, you talk about there being evidence that both Yao Kanan and Matanyah were originally written in Hebrew, and he was wondering if you would share that evidence.
When I say Yao Kanan, I list every occurrence of cherries in the oldest manuscripts. So I list every single one. And there's my recollection is that there's the one that comes up early in Yao Kanan is in a third century manuscript, and that it does say cherries in a third century manuscript, and that the ones attributed to Yahusha in Revelation I don't think are affirmed in any early manuscripts. I think there's just the one. But anyway, I did the complete research, and it's all published in Questioning Paul. There is absolute, undeniable proof that Matanyah was written in Hebrew, and then the Hebrew copies were confiscated by rabbis and then by the Hadrian, and anything that was written in Hebrew was confiscated and burned by Hadrian, and that right after Rabbi Akiva, and immediately before and after Rabbi Akiva, the group of Yahudim that followed Yahusha and spoke Hebrew and were Torah observant, they were hunted down by the Jewish rabbis and anything that they, in fact, the Talmud is really explicit in this, how they, and I've shared this in one of the books, but how they went out in order to find and to confiscate and to destroy the Hebrew texts associated with the Yehudim that were Torah observant and following the Yahusha. So we have historical affirmations from both the Roman side and the rabbinic side of the fact that the documents written by disciples were written in Hebrew. There are specific references to Matanyah being written in Hebrew, and the rabbinic accounts just speak of these eyewitness accounts by the disciples being circulated in Hebrew, but they don't mention a name. But there's multiple of them, and the only option beyond Matanyah, which you know for certain because it's in Roman documents having been written in Hebrew, is Yahuchanan. So the assumption is that it's, and when you look at distribution of these, of the eyewitness accounts, far and away the most popular in Yisrael was Matanyah, and second to that was Yahuchanan. And overall, Yahuchanan outside of Yisrael was the most popular, second only to, then second would be Matanyah outside of Yisrael. But inside of Yisrael, where the people spoke Hebrew, Matanyah was the most popular. Yahuchanan was the second most popular. So based upon that, you put the pieces together, you'd say that both of them were written in Hebrew and later translated into to Greek. We have no knowledge of Yahuchanan being able to speak or write Greek prior to the fulfillment of Shavuah in 33 CE. But even then, the description...
Why would
he? Yeah, he was a fisherman. I mean, none of these guys spoke or wrote Greek. None of them. None of them could speak, write, or read Greek when Yahusha asked them to join him. I mean, Matanyah was the only businessman. He was a tax collector. And the rest were fishermen. One was a carpenter. None of them could had any familiarity with Greek. Couldn't speak it, couldn't read it, couldn't write it. And so there is a 0% possibility that they wrote their accounts in a language they had no affinity for and did not understand. At Shavuah, they would have been given the ability to speak Greek to a Greek audience, but there'd be no reason for Yahuchanan to write what he wrote in Greek. And now, the other issue is, so that's first of all, Yosha is the only one we care about, by the way, in the so-called Christian New Testament. We only care about one voice. We don't care about what Matanyah himself thinks. We don't care what Yahuchanan thinks. We don't care what Matanyah wrote. We don't care what Yahuchanan wrote. All we care about in the so-called Christian New Testament is what Yahusha said. And you will not find Cheris in Yahusha's words recorded in any pre-Constantine manuscript. So it is possible that Yahuchanan could have... Now, and what, by the way, I have to ask you this, JB, since Terry is conveying his question through you. Yahuchanan, Cheris. Do you see a conflict there? What is Yahuchanan comprised of?
Chanan.
Right. What is Chan and Chanan in Hebrew? Mercy, right? Right. His very name conveys the Hebrew concept of mercy. It's Yah is merciful. If you were to pick somebody that wouldn't know that Yahweh's term is Chanan, The last person on Earth
he'd be the last guy.
Is a guy named Yao Connors.
You know, that's
pretty
scary
much
position.
That answers the question. And by the way, it's not in Yaosha's voice. He's not saying it.
Yeah.
And by the way, Yaosha never once ever spoke or wrote Greek. Ever.
No. I read that posting, and Terry's position was it probably said Karis, not Charity, and that's the whole point or Chonin rather.
It's at Chonin, Yao Conan spoke and wrote Hebrew, Matanya spoke and wrote Hebrew, Yaosha spoke in Hebrew. And so they're trying to say what Yaosha said it did.
Because it isn't like Marcion was trying to translate anything perfectly either. But just because they're pre-Constantine doesn't mean Marcion didn't have his grubby paws all over him, because he did.
Yeah, and it's not just Marcion. The scribatoriums in Alexandria, which is where 99.9% of the pre-Constantine manuscripts come from, the scribatoriums in Alexandria, Egypt. They were religious institutions. They were funded by religious zealots. Their purpose was never to accurately convey what had been written. Their purpose was to have a document that could be used to promote the religion. And now, that would have been different when you had Montanya and Yao Conan's account in Hebrew being shared amongst the Yehudim who were Torah observant in Israel. But by the time that they were being distributed to the Greek world and translated into Greek in Alexandria, Egypt, you know, you've lost all desire for textual integrity. And we know that there was no desire for textual integrity because there's no common threads amongst these manuscripts. There's more variations than there are words. So the proof is undeniable that there's no textual commitment to accuracy. Now, the last thing I would say is that of the four biographical accounts, the one that is the least trustworthy is not actually Luke, and you'd be concerned about Luke because everything in Luke is hearsay, and Luke was strongly influenced by Paul. But it's not the one that, when I read Luke, I want to puke. I mean, twisted and out of order, and it's like, you know, kids playing telephone. I don't think that Luke deliberately tried to misrepresent. He just didn't have any direct access, and so he was getting lots of people's hearsay opinions, and he tried to piece it together.
It's an interesting historical document.
Yeah, but it's not accurate historically because when you read Luke, you can find that there are huge historical errors. I mean, there's historical errors throughout Luke, including the timeline of what Yaosha said and when he said it. He doesn't ever get the context right. I think he tried. It's just that he was too far removed from it to be able to
fit.
But the one that's the least reliable is actually Yao Conan. Yao Conan is the least reliable, and it's the least.
Yeah, you said
it
was the most manipulated.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that. I mean, listen, I think Yao Conan is probably a terrific guy. I'm looking forward to one day meeting Yao Conan. Yeah, it just seems like Yao Conan strikes me as he's a Larry. And he's in your face. He's passionate. He's going to tell it like he sees it. He was engaged, man. He's going to be a fun guy to hang with. But I'm making the statement that Yao Conan is the least reliable because it is the most manipulated. If you look at the difference between the earliest manuscripts of Yao Conan and what we have as the basis of English translations today, it was the most prone to manipulation. Not Yao Conan's fault, the church's fault. And so it becomes the least reliable because it was the most manipulated. And so the standard that I use on all of these things, you know, because we all have to establish how what are we going to take that we think is credible and what are we're going to reject. And what I do is if you're reading something that is a citation of or a paraphrase of or an understanding derived from something that's in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, and it's in Yahusha's voice, and it is consistent with the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, and I can go to the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms and translate what has been cited in now in Greek and Hebrew, then I'm going to view that as 99.999% reliable. So, for example, the Sermon on the Mount, virtually everything in the Sermon on the Mount can be found affirmed in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. I'm viewing it as 99.99% reliable. Now, I have one other thing. Beyond, so I'm using essentially the test that Yahweh articulated in Devarim 13 and 18. You know, is it consistent with what already exists in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms? Is it accurate in terms of what has happened and will happen going forward? Does it eliminate the names of foreign and fake gods? I'm using, is the person communicating it, do they have an ego? Are they directing us to Yahweh and not to themselves? If you apply Yahweh's test, the things that you read in Matanya, from beginning to end, what you read in Matanya is consistent. For example, the Olivet Discourse in Matanya, it's a citation of Zechariah. You just go to Zechariah, translate it out of Hebrew, and you know what he said. Now, the third test, I should say, that I use. So, you know, one is, can I find it in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms? Is it consistent with that? Is it in Yosha's voice? And the third is, if it is opposed to Christianity, and I'll just go back to the Sermon on the Mount, wholly and completely opposed to Christianity. When Yosha said, I came in my Father's name, and you don't not receive me, and another will come in his own name, and him you will receive, that is wholly opposed to Christianity. And so if I'm reading the beginning of Revelation, and it's speaking of the various ages, and every bit of it's opposed to Christianity, and then we go to the end, and you read, come out of her, my people, and he's still talking about the influence of Babylon, and I can go back to Daniel and know how the final beast that grew out of Babylon still influences the world, and I can make those connections in Yosha's voice, and it's opposed to Christianity, the likelihood of it being accurate is really high. And if it's something like the adulterous woman, and Yosha said, he without sin cast the first stone, and because they don't condemn you, I don't condemn you either. If I'm reading something like that that is written to benefit Christianity, and it's inconsistent with the Torah, it's inconsistent with Yosha, then I'm going to reject it.
I puke, and then I reject it.
So, what you find on Sharia
you would actually think about it. In other words, you're actually thinking about these things?
Yes, but what I realize is there is no light that goes off above every word when you read them and say, all right, this word is credible, this next word is not credible, this word is credible, the next one's not credible. The only way that you can go about doing it, at least in my, I've concluded, having studied the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, is the only way that you can go about doing it is to diligently examine it, closely examine, carefully consider, and then apply the Devarim 13 and 18 test, which, if you're to boil it down, is the person speaking on behalf of Yahweh without any personal ego and agenda? Is what they're saying consistent with what Yahweh has already said? Is it extant in Yahweh's existing testimony? Does it have the names of foreign gods? Are the things which are proclaimed in it, is there some evidence of prophecy in it, which is Yahweh's signature, and of the prophecies in it, are they universally accurate? And I go through that process, and then I have one other filter that is not specified in the Torah prophets and Psalms, but I think it's implied. And that is, I look at what is said and I say, is it consistent with the nature, character, purpose, will of Yahweh as he reveals himself in the Torah prophets and Psalms? If it is, I'm fully willing to accept it. If it is not, I'm going to reject it. But yeah, I think about it. Is there another way? If somebody's got another way of knowing what is and isn't reliable other than going to the effort of examining it and comparing it and thinking about it, you know, I happen to like, but, you know, not everybody does. I was
being a little tongue-in-cheek.
I know, but maybe there is another way. I mean, the only way that I
know... Well, you better think about
it. ...is to invest
time... That goes back to the animal that regurgitates its food and rechews it again, you know, chewing its cud. I mean, that's...
Right. And the separated the purpose of the separated hoop. Can you make a distinction between things? And the way that you're going to walk and the way that you're going to establish yourself, can you make a distinction? Can you separate that which is good from that which is bad? I mean, personally, I think that's the thrill of the hunt in this case. I'm hunting for the truth, hunting for knowledge, and the thrill of the hunt is being able to find information and process it. Right. And what you want to be
careful
of...
You know, I do
of,
have one question here.
Yeah. Can
I have
think,
a question
think,
here.
One thought, one final thought, and I want to hear your question. The thrill of it is getting yourself too out of the way, not taking yourself too seriously. For example, I know you were tongue-in-cheek when you asked the question, when you said you thought
sure.
it. But my answer was, I'm going to share with you the process that I use based upon what Yahweh has said, but I'm not going to claim that I'm always right. I'm not making that claim. I'm not going to say that, you know, you need to follow what I'm doing. All I can do is share, this is what I've learned. This is what I find is rewarding, and I'm encouraging others to, you know, explore the same way.
Yeah, you never, ever said you were right about everything. Matter of fact, you're constantly most of the time you're not wrong. You're just fine-honing. Every now and then you make the mistake, and then you go back, you rewrite it. I mean, I don't see other people do that, by the way.
Yeah.
Congratulations for that.
Yeah, so
there was
a
group.
And then JB's got a follow-up question.
Well, there was a group. We went over earlier, why would Yahweh have entire tribes killed? And we have all these names. You know, we have the names of all these groups.
Yeah, they weren't tribes that were killed. They were villages
cities,
and towns.
People or whatever.
Yeah,
yeah,
villages
right.
and towns. There were about a dozen of them that he wanted eliminated. You know, collectively they represented
I see why, you know, we kill the moon people and you know, the evil idolatrous hill and the invincible individuals and all that stuff. But there was one that was basically Dabar, which is fear and revere the word.
Yeah.
Which
well,
is
the reason that Yahweh wanted the people that were in the promised land killed prior to the his children moving in is because Yahweh consistently presents the nature of religion and politics as a deadly disease. It's
yes.
an infectious, deadly disease. It's far more infectious than Ebola, far deadlier than Ebola, and he realizes, and he tells us constantly, that religion and politics are the deadliest of all diseases, and no loving father is going to move his family into a home that's infested with a contagious, deadly disease. And so when you realize, and this is something that I thought was so important about the Ebola outbreak that helps you understand Yahweh's response to his children coming home, is that once you realize that somebody is infected with Ebola, the most compassionate thing you can do is to let them die.
Yeah, well,
because
if you
try to save them, if you try to help them, you're going to spread
yourself.
The disease. And thousands of people who would not otherwise die from the disease and suffer from the disease are going to suffer and die because you made the wrong choice to try to save somebody from the disease. It's far better to let those infected die.
I do, though, think I have the answer to this one. The only one that I was wondering about was Dabar. But I'm seeing that that is to fear or revere the word. Obviously, in their case, they feared it.
Right.
That's the conclusion I'd come to there. Yeah. So.
But anyway, he does describe. He names the towns. I think it's about a dozen of them. The children of Israel only acted in about a quarter of them. Three quarters of them, they did not act. They suffered the consequences of that. That's how they ended up embracing the evil ways of the Gentiles, is they did not remove the disease from their midst. And Israel became extraordinarily polluted with religion, which is why Hezekiah could not celebrate. Once he read the Torah, he could not celebrate Pesach in time. Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkudim in time, because there was way too much work to be done ridding Yisrael and Yehudah in particular of religious imagery. It was so pervasive, and that's because the children of Yisrael did not honor their father's instructions to rid the home of this deadly pathogen prior to moving in. And you know, Yosha explains, says, you know, their disease, their iniquity, this corruption for them has reached a point of overflowing, and it is complete, which means there is no hope. They can't be saved. So to try to send somebody in to try to save that which is corrupt beyond salvation, all that's going to do is cause more people to die. So to prematurely take a life, to shorten a life by a matter of days, weeks, or years of someone certain to die, and thereby exposing others to death, that would be an unloving thing to do. Yahweh's choice was far more compassionate than loving.
Yeah, especially when you consider the fact that Yahweh exists outside of time, and he knows for a fact that there was no hope for these people. We are not in a position to judge that, but he is.
Yeah, right. You know, it's not that in fact, he never gives us any instructions beyond those dozen villages at that specific place, his home, at that specific time. And there are no other instructions, and that instructions were for that purpose and that purpose alone, trying to establish something that, you know, we could understand. But you're right. He is in a position where he can do that. For example, if you were to shorten a life, if we could take Stickman for a moment, and let's say that I actually had the skill to create a living Stickman, and I let living Stickman live for 3 weeks, but at the end of the third week, I ended Stickman's life. Was I mean to end Stickman's life, or was I generous in giving Stickman 3 weeks of life? And since Yahweh is the source of life, all of those who lived in the promised land of those 12 different towns and villages, whose life he wanted truncated, was he being mean or generous? He gave them life in the first place. Without him, they would not have had any life. For him to say, that is the end of your life because I don't want you infecting my children, it's actually generous. He gave them life that they would never otherwise have had, whether that life was days, weeks, months, or years.
You know, there's a lot of warnings about religion. I mean, you know, in taking up religion, using religious terms, or looking at him in a religious context, which is really what he's doing here.
Right.
You know, saying, look, I really, really long for this relationship. Look what I'm willing to do to get it.
Right.
Which is just about anything other than lie.
Yes, but, you know, you look at, back at that situation, the question that you asked, Larry, if I killed, let's say that you create Donut Man, and if I go squish your Donut Man, I didn't give life to Donut Man. That would be unfair. I have no right to take the life of Donut Man. But if I created Stick Man, I have every right to Stick Man's existence.
That's a point well taken. I absolutely agree with that. What you will find when you're debating, as particularly atheists in this case, you'll find them get all angry, you know, when he...
Right, of course, they get...
They're the ones who try to use that
thing.
Arguing
and then,
point.
But then you also have to have, is what you've said, Yahweh exists outside the constraint of time. And you know what?
Right.
Etched in stone that the promotion of that which is deceitful and deadly, and religion is the primary source of that which is deceitful and deadly, that's an unforgivable sin, particularly when practiced on an ongoing basis. When your practice of religion reaches the point where it is completely full, where you are completely encapsulated by that religion, then your ongoing basis for doing so is never going to be stopped. You've reached a point where there is 0% chance that you're ever going to stop practicing that religion. That's what the Hebrew concept being conveyed means. And if you are a position where you are never going to stop, you're never going to walk away from that religion, there's a 0% possibility that you can be saved.
But it also says something about how damning, how deadly religion is.
Correct.
Each one of these represent either a philosophy of man or a religion of some type.
Yep.
And they're so damning, they're so condemning that not even one person in a village was worth saving.
Not worth saving, even could be saved.
Yeah,
worth saving is true, but even could be saved. You know, when Yahweh is talking about the tests for the false prophet, for somebody creating a religious myth in the Torah, doesn't he equate that individual with death? That person is deadly? And when Yahweh speaks of Sheol, of Shaul, of Paul, and talks about his circuitous reasoning and his grand preposterous and egotistical diatribe, doesn't he say it's like the plague of death?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
so
absolutely.
From Yahweh's point of view, there is nothing more deadly than this. This is the ultimate malignant thing in the universe. You know, when Yahweh realized that there was no hope for mankind apart from a flood and to get rid of humans with a nesama, that had become disgustingly religious at the time of Noah, and that the only chance was to wipe them out, otherwise there was no hope for humankind. I mean, that's what we're talking about
here. Yeah, the Nephilim, that means people that prostrate themselves, doesn't it?
Right, yes.
They were clearly religious people he was wiping out even then. He said it made him sad, but they were some of the names, you know, runs rings around God.
Some of the
names these people had were just outrageous, And I look at those things, and then, you know, of course, I see it drip off people in conversations. I see it in television shows. I see it in statements people make. It gets to the point where you're just looking at them, and you're thinking, you are so dead, you have no idea.
Well, I'll give you a great example of this. While we were having lunch today, my son was talking about how disgusted he is by those that our society lifts up as examples of somebody to be praised and somebody to be followed and somebody to be acknowledged, and he used the Kardashians and Kim Kardashian. Now I have this hearsay because I have never watched any program with the Kardashians in them. I wouldn't know Kim Kardashian if she were to walk in this room. So I'm completely ignorant here. But his statement was is that Kim Kardashian's claim to fame is a homemade porno tape that she publicized that was with some sports athlete and that it was her in a porno tape that she publicized that made the rounds around the internet was her claim to fame, and that's the basis of this family's claim to fame. And then you've got, you know, Kris Jenner somehow marrying into all of this and him going around now as a transvestite, changing into a woman. I mean, and if that is what we're going to promote, if we're going to offer television shows and notoriety and public interest to these kinds of tramps,
I don't
What's
even know who
with
she
that?
Is. I've heard the name, but I don't know who she is. So I, It's pretty bad, the people that are lifted up in our society. And it almost, it gives me pause. It makes me very concerned, you know, that I live in such a vile place. You know, hopefully none of it gets scraped off on me. I mean, I think I'm right in the middle of it.
Yeah, I think a lot of it does on all of us, which is why no matter how hard we try to walk away from the influence of our society, some of it clings to us, which is why the Torah and its remedies were crafted for imperfect people.
Yeah, that's what the Mitzvah was about.
Right.
Was
so long as we make an
solve
effort,
all these disputes.
Right. So long as we make an effort to distance ourselves from religion and politics and make an effort to answer Yahweh's invitations to meet with him, he's not really expecting a lot more from us. The whole plan is for flawed people. It's not for perfect people. So, you know, we're influenced by the negativity.
There are
no
perfect people.
No. Well, there are.
Well,
I realize that. Right.
I realize we're all. I'm certainly a lot less than perfect. Don't. I don't claim to be perfect.
But you just think of where you have come in terms of character, and thinking and perspective and.
Perspective is completely different, and
benefits to humankind over these past 5 years. Just think of how far you've come.
Yeah, well, you know, I think about it because I.
Oh yeah.
Well, you know, again, you might recall that I had said, you know, I realized that a person would have to be like Noah or Abraham or Dod.
Right.
You know, if they were going to make it, I realized it was a one in a million situation.
Right.
And, you know, I knew that walking into it, you know,
right.
When I finally realized it was all real and, you know, and I told you it was the 6 days and nights, you know, the light and all that. I mean, that's real is real.
Right.
And so, you know, I came to a point to understand this is all real and I'm going to have to be a one in a million guy. And then you really look at Dod, and that was really the guy I looked at, to be honest with you. How do you be like Dod?
Right.
And, you know, you look at his responses saying, you know, my past life didn't amount to a hill of beans. Nothing I did was really worth anything. What's worth it is listening to you and following your precepts. And that's the bottom line. Because the minute you can give up on counting on yourself, which that is really the religious notion.
The you that Larry is speaking of is not JB and it's not me, it's Yahweh. It should be pretty obvious, but I just want to make certain that Larry is not addressing me or JB here. He's addressing.
No, not at all.
He's citing Dod, and Dod is saying that the only one worth listening to is Yahweh.
Yeah, well, exactly, and that's what I meant to say. It's clear that. Dod said he himself couldn't count on himself.
Correct.
I mean, that's what he said.
Right.
You know, if you go to the Mizmor 119:67, you know, he's saying, you know, prior to the time that I responded and answered this invitation,
mm-hmm.
before I was thoughtful, spoke truthfully, and composed these songs, I was preoccupied and unintentionally I erred.
Yeah.
I inadvertently wandered aimlessly. Without deliberation, I sinned without meaning to do so because I was unwittingly deceived and therefore placed my trust in mistaken opinions. But now, at this point in time, I literally keep my eyes totally focused upon carefully and completely observing, closely examining, diligently exploring, and genuinely evaluating, investigating, scrutinizing, the complete totality of your word, your instruction, and your promise. So, you know, again, we could go back to Dod. You know, he's the shepherd boy with the rock standing in front of the whole army. Everybody else is shaking. He steps up to the plate, and you think, wow, he's my hero. And that had nothing to do with it, according to him.
You know,
he didn't know what he was doing back then.
You know, when you read that statement from Dod, you know what's the thing that strikes me? Real.
Mm-hmm.
That's real.
Yeah, it's honest.
That's real. That's honest. That's all of us. And that's all of us having made the transition from being negatively influenced by all sorts of stupid, mistaken rhetoric and forming
religious traditions,
religious opinions, and
yep.
stumbling aimlessly as a result of that. Not try. I mean, I don't think people are Christians to piss off God. I don't think people
no,
are Muslims to
ignorant.
Piss off God.
No.
They're just misled. And so, for him to say that and say,
yeah.
but you know, now that I found what's real, what's dependable, now that I can change the lies and the opinions and the error for that which is real, you know, I'm going with what's real. I'm going with what's truthful. I'm going with your word.
Yeah, it's just absolute. Yeah, and I'm
That's
trusting your word.
We all
I'm not trusting
lies,
in myself. I'm not
truth,
trusting
we abandoned
in his,
that.
Yeah, I'm not trusting in errant opinions anymore. And,
no.
and you know, it's obvious that we can't.
Yes.
It's obvious that I don't know how to save myself.
You know,
for
example, both of you guys, I trust both of you. I'm looking forward to spending eternity with you. I think great guys. We're family. I trust you, but I don't trust you as much as any more than I trust myself. And I trust myself, you know, a billionth, trillionth of what I trust you. that bottom line here. And most people I don't trust at all. Most people, I'm always on my guard. But the brothers and the sisters in the covenant, I trust. And,
yeah, I do too. But
Yahweh, I trust explicitly. I mean, and yet even with Yahweh,
yeah,
I question everything he says. I question everything.
Well, he even tells you to do it.
Yeah, I don't mean
check,
the question is not,
me up
it's not
on
a bad
check
thing.
Check it out.
Bad way. I want to check it out. I want to check it out. I question everything he said. I don't question it to say, you know, hey, did you get this one right? You know, I know going in, he got everything right. You know, I know everything he said is consistent.
You,
is.
You wonder if coming out, it came across right.
Right. You know,
I'm mostly
questioning it. You know, why did you say it? What can I learn from
it? You wonder why it's right.
Yeah, why did you say it this way? What can I gain from it? What can I learn from it? What should I share based upon this? What do I need to correct based upon this? You know, where does this take us? I question everything he says. I think that questioning, having a questioning mind is what enables us to think. Didn't Yahweh tell us, you know, why don't we question Paul? I mean, he wants us to question. You think that when Yahweh created the test in Devarim, and he's introducing the test, doesn't he say, if you question in your heart whether this is from God, here's what you should do? So isn't he telling us that he expects us to question?
Yeah, he's saying do the homework. There's no question
no,
about
exactly.
that. The more
and
homework you do, the less you question.
And
that's what happens.
Not just false ones.
Correct. Yeah, he's not just saying,
Isaiah
I want you to question the false
for God.
Ones.
He wanted us to apply that test to Isaiah.
Correct. Absolutely, because if you read what's in the test, most of what's in the test is consistent with what you would find in his prophets. And so there would be no reason for him to give the things that we should expect to see unless he also wants us to do it with Yashayah, with Yirmiyah, with Zechariah.
Yeah, and of course they all meet that standard, and they all sound like they were written by the same individual.
It's also helpful if the name associated with the conduit that Yahweh is using is a name that has meaning that's directly attributable to the message that's being conveyed. For example, Noah being trustworthy guide, Moshe being the one who drawing the people out of the place. A merciful father with Abraham. Yahusha, as in Yahusha, the son of Nun meaning the infinitive, the perpetual one. And Yahusha was trying to save his people as they would come into their new home. And Yahusha being
Yahusha. Or Agawar, that would
right.
be another one.
Or Matthew and Yahochanan being the two disciples that provided an eyewitness account to us. Or the very kingdom.
Or he who is lowly and little.
Oh, yes. Or they, yeah, or yeah.
Let me run up to right. that, yeah.
Or Shaul, it means to question him. Being a name that is not associated with the Yahweh's message. But then you're dealing even with Matanyah and Yahochanan, being the two eyewitnesses, or the very fellow whose psalms we've been examining, the person that Yahweh clearly loves more than anyone in human history, and what does his dadgum name mean? Beloved. I mean,
no.
So if the, you know, if you're dealing with a prophet that's going to lay out the entire plan of salvation, and his name is Yahshayah, a combination of Yasha, the Hebrew word for salvation, and Yah, oh, that's a pretty good name. That's a good start. Right?
Yeah, obviously, you know, the name, you know, you want to look at it. So, you know, that's why I brought up he was lowly and little.
Right.
You got all these people, Eliah, you know,
right.
Daniel. You got all these people with these wonderful names, and then you run across he who is lowly and little that opposes, you know.
Right. Yeah, right. If you're
and of course,
looking at,
it makes sense.
You know, condemning, disassociating himself, divorcing himself of Israel. And you have the book written by a man named Salvation. You know, okay, I don't want to be divorced. Maybe I ought to listen to what Yahweh says through a man named Salvation. Or if I want to know what's going to happen in the future, that maybe a prophet named, remember this, Zechariah, might be a good place to turn. You know, if I want to know the message of Yahweh, how about a prophet named Malachi, messenger?
Yeah,
if I want to pick,
exactly.
If I want to pick the name of the of Yahweh's corporeal manifestation, how about a name like Yahusha that means Yahweh saves? It really isn't hard to figure this out.
That's what he came to do.
Correct. Or when you're dealing with who was the person who was brought in to be a conduit on behalf of, a communicator on behalf of the message that Yahweh was conveying through Moshe. What did the man's name mean? What was his name and what does his name mean? The guy that was deployed by Yahweh to be a conduit between he through Moshe to the children of
Aaron?
Israel. Yes, Aaron. What does his name mean?
Haron.
Means enlightened free will.
Enlightened free will.
Enlightened free will. Wait, how could you have a better name than that for that job? You know, I'm sharing the Torah with you for the purpose of
perfect.
Enlightened free will. Yeah.
You combine it with Moshe. I'm drawing you out so that you can use your enlightened free will.
There you go. Yes. Exactly. You know, and when you're going to name the first five books the Torah, and then you tell us that Torah is based on the Hebrew verb yara, and yara means the source from which instruction, guidance, and teaching flow, and then you're going to name the capital of the promised land, Jerusalem, which is a combination of shalom, reconciliation, and Yara. So it's the place from which teaching and guidance regarding reconciliation flows. You know, you're going to name the promised land Yisrael and its individuals who engage and endure with God. You're going to name the chosen people Yahuda and Yahudim, those who relate to Yah and those who are related to Yah. I mean, you can just search the names, and the names will provide all the affirmation you need. Do you find any of those names in Paul's letters? I mean,
no,
you find a Barnabas, you find a Timothy, you know, you find men named after Greek and Roman gods and goddesses. No.
No, absolutely
yeah.
not. If you're asking me, I mean, that's
yeah.
rhetorical, I know. It's
yeah.
just obvious.
Right. Yeah, well. thank you guys for starting up the show and having a meaningful conversation before I got here. And you know,
we had a good time.
Yeah, it's I think, and I was listening to you for a good long while. It's you were playing off of each other beautifully, and when you're doing it as a conversation, it's so much more fun. I think it's been more beneficial for everybody. It's more fun for us and more beneficial for everybody to do it that way. And one of the, I think, the biggest advantages, fellas, is that spontaneity is more genuine, and we can always be spontaneous when we know Yahweh. Once you come to know Him, once that is your frame, the means that you frame everything, that's your perspective on everything. Once you come to that understanding, then you can always be extemporaneous without any concern, and that it's far more genuine.
Oh, exactly.
It's real.
Yeah,
to use the term that you're dealing with, and I'm not sure, Larry, that there are better ways to summarize all of this than real. You know, Christianity is a pile of lies. It's not real. Jesus is not real. Allah is not real. Muhammad's not real. The Torah, prophets, and Psalms, Yahweh. Now, that's real. It's
real.
No, yeah.
And
well, you know, again, you can always tell the flow of the words and all that. I mean,
yeah.
You can really tell when they're coming from Yahweh.
The passage
that you read
is that obviously an amplified translation of it.
Obviously.
And closely examined and carefully considered was shared from many different perspectives. And apart from that being a bit wordy, but, you know, it's wordy for a reason. We need to know what observe means. That statement is real. It's credible. It's the exact thing I experienced. I can take every one of those worlds and say, that is exactly my experience. Totally,
yeah,
completely real in my life. I know it's that you read that too, and you say, well, that describes your journey too, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I sit down and one thing I know about Yahweh's words is they fit perfectly together. Now, there's been a number of rational people that I've sent into Yada Yah, and they all come out saying the same thing. They've been looking for this stuff for years and years and years, and they finally found something that fits.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
That's because Yahweh's words do fit, if you think
right.
about
that
it.
That was me.
You put them together correctly.
Yeah. I think it's true with all of us that once we see Yahweh's testimony as it was intended for us to consider it, and we closely examine and carefully consider it, it's real, it all fits. And that's the reason why I think all of us are so personally joyous about the whole thing, so celebratory, so comfortable, so liberated in the whole thing. You're so relaxed, so liberated, so happy about the whole thing, and yet you're pissed off that you've got so many morons out there that are leading people astray, and they know it. They're deliberately leading them astray.
When I get really angry, it's when I've spent a lot of time with somebody on a couple of posts.
Yes.
And some Christian, I'm going to save this guy from Satan. You know, and this is really their perspective. It is so twisted. They jump in there and they start quoting Paul.
Yeah.
And that's what they do every time.
Yeah,
and,
so I've changed
or
a little bit, Larry, and I think this may happen to you, but I'm not, maybe not. But first of all, Yosha got angry, Yahweh gets angry, so there's nothing wrong with getting angry. My anger now is mostly when I've worked with somebody, tried to direct them to Yahweh, and I've spent a lot of time, and I fail. They just continue to be religious. I'm actually not angry at them. I'm angry at myself for wasting that time.
Oh, man.
Been so much more productive doing something else. So,
I had a week before this one, I had that with
six people. But the handful of times that actually succeeds makes all the wasted time worth it.
Yeah, and it's not actually handfuls. It's hundreds and approaching thousands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very rare, but it makes that worth it.
Yeah, and you know, some, like I had one that was a Richard kind of. Richard is a nicer version of what I was 10 years ago. 10 years ago, man, I wouldn't suffer a fool at all. And if somebody just began to hint at foolishness, I mean, I'd just spit them out. And Richard was really pretty nice about it. But you know, Richard does—he's no nonsense man. He knows the truth, and he won't tolerate religious corruption. And he sent this guy off to me.
Is that the one we got in all the emails with there for a while?
Perhaps, yeah. Because it started like, all right, he's going to continue to sample, you know, from the rabbis and sample from Paul and sample from this and sample for that and try to ascertain what was valuable or not. And you know, I was right there at the edge. This is just not going to work. I'm before I get mad at myself for wasting my time, I should just hit delete. And I didn't for some reason. And this was the guy that said, you know, what you're saying makes sense. I think what I need to do is keep an open mind and not try to pick things apart, and should devote the time to read. And then as he would devote the time to read, he came back and said, oh, my, oh, my, oh, my, oh, my. I get it.
Yeah, it turns out all this is real.
Yeah,
wow,
I'm not in Disney World
anymore.
It's
a strange thing, but it's one of the reasons that I make notes, and I put a lot of them out. You know, I'll take a section of yada yada, and or ITG, one or the other, and I'll make a note out of it, and I'll connect it to another place, you know, where you're talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's some other prophet writings, or you know, one of the writings of one of the other. Guys, and you know, I put them in an order where they make perfect sense, and then people start going, wow, this is great, you got more, and I'll put 10 or 12 more out to them, and I'll say, you know, how would you like to have 1,200 pages of extant study, preface to, you know, 3,000 pages, man, are you kidding, I've been waiting for this all my life. That's how you get them in. You got to make small notes.
Right.
And you got to get them reading them. They got to make sense, and then boom,
you've got
the material.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. Then I'm not such a genius, but that's not my point.
Yeah. But you know, the way I look at it is that.
Well, you know, not to stroke your ego, but to give you encouragement. A lot of those emails that you've forwarded me that have not been productive, I posted in the forum, and they have been very helpful to other people. So.
Well, good.
Just to encourage you to continue to reply to those emails. It may not help the person you're talking to, but it is helping people.
Okay. And
well, in this case, it obviously did. So you just never know.
Yeah.
You never know.
It helped the person, so.
Yeah, and a lot of times I would answer emails knowing that I can't help this person, but maybe by this being posted someplace, it might help somebody else. And I think, Larry, your whole Facebook outreach was that you debated a lot of scummy religious people, knowing that you were
for a long time
them, but that others reading this, that maybe 1 in 100 people reading it would say, "Oh, wow, somebody finally got it figured out," and they would turn to you. Because I had so many people write me letters like that. You know, this is the bottom line for me. When I examine something that humans are promoting, the closer I look, the more flawed it becomes. When I look at what Yahweh is conveying, the closer I look, the more magnificent it becomes. And that's true. I found that to be true of everything that man says and everything and man has invented and everything that Yahweh has invented. You know, you look at life and you get down to the DNA and RNA level and you have this elegant double helix and you realize now that you have a three-dimensional language. I mean, it's impossible. In fact, almost every time you look at the double helix of DNA, you almost hear a symphony going off in the background as to how at its base level, it is so elegant, so beautiful, so profound. And then you look at the things of man, and the closer you look, the more flawed it is. And yeah, that's a pretty good test.
I think it was Gerald Schroeder described the splitting of molecules as a ballet.
Yeah.
On the scale of molecules, the reproduction of single-celled organism is like a ballet. It's the intricacy of it.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Life is magnificent. You know, the element, how matter is simply organized energy, and the translation between energy and matter is magnificent. But it doesn't even compare to the magnificence that is life.
Well, do you know what really exactly threw me? You know, when they finally realized that this is an actual language, you know, which of course puts it off the charts in terms of accidentally happening and everything else, was Stephen Hawking's coming out saying that proves there's not a God. I said, you know, when was the last time there was a language that there wasn't an author of the language? What are you talking about?
Right.
I mean, this guy, within his own mind, I mean, he must be one frustrated genius because he's pinned down to a wheelchair or something.
You know, I think
there's something wrong with
almost everything that Stephen Hawking conceived has been shown to be wrong. He completely discredited himself when he began to talk about the destruction of matter and how, he said, well, the way that we resolve the fact that matter can be destroyed is that it goes into a parallel universe. And he came up with the parallel universe theory to justify his statement that was in conflict with really the foundation of science and the conservation of energy and matter. And so I think he's a fellow that sought to be brilliant, and his study was almost exclusively focused on black holes and trying to understand black holes, and he never got beyond the event horizon, and the fact is that there's only so much we can know about black holes. We'll never investigate one. There's only so much we can know, and there's so much about a black hole that just does not make sense. Like, you know, there's enormous amount of energy that streams out of a black hole, so energy can escape a black hole, and yet black holes are at the center of virtually every galaxy, and yet the stars aren't drawn into it and consumed. You know, so there's a lot going on. We don't get yet. He devoted his life to it and ended up not being able to substantially advance what is known, and then came up with some very odd theories, trying to make a splash late in his life, and made a complete fool of himself. Yeah. Oh well.
Well, he made an ass of himself with that statement. Come on, this language accidentally. This language, which is how many characters? Many characters in
but,
DNA?
The fact is four characters.
More complex
DNA
than the most complex human language ever created.
Yeah, RNA is five, DNA is four, and the chromosomes, which you know are part of the human genome, is 22 there. But the if you take RNA and the five and you double it, you got 10. You take DNA and you triple it, you have 12. And you add them together, you got the same 22. And two and three would really talk about the very nature of this dual three dimensional language. It's a three dimensional language in that, but in dual strands in the helix. So you multiply one by two, the other by three, and you have the same 22 all over again. But
isn't that interesting? And we have 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Strange.
Yeah. You know, so when science came up with the realization that life is organized by a database that's called DNA, that's written in a three-dimensional language, and then it's processed, conveyed by RNA, which translates the DNA out of the database. And then the program that operates from that language is proteins. and we figured out that this was by far more complex than any computer that man had ever conceived, computer code or program, and we didn't come to the natural conclusion, wait a minute, you've got a three-dimensional language and a computer code here. And this spontaneously emerged out of inorganic material. Say what? Want to give me the plug?
Yeah, well, that's why I started thinking this guy is a frustrated genius. That's bizarre.
Yeah.
That simply went insane. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to figure out this doesn't accidentally happen.
No.
In fact, you're a boob if you think
you are. You are. You just at that point. But you know, understand his perspective. Here's a guy with an enormous ego because he thinks he's so smart, who is confined to this horrible, mangled position where he can't speak, he can't move, and so he's angry at God. He thinks he's smarter than God, and he's angry at God all at the same time.
Yeah, I've thought of that. Yeah, and plus he's got a sick body. You don't have a healthy mind when you have a body that sick. Isn't possible.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, if I look at my own ability just to process information, to think, and that sort of thing, now that I've gotten a lot healthier, more fit, and lost so much weight, and just feel so much better, it's amazing the difference in being fit. That's not to say
the thought process, is definitely enhanced. I mean, I went the other way because I took a real bad injury and gained weight, and there's a definite difference in the two. I mean, that's one of the reasons you stay fit is to be able to think properly.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. All right, fellas. Well, thank you again for doing this, and I appreciate you covering for me. You know, this was really a pleasure because I knew I was out doing things that I should be doing as a husband and father. And I just knew that you guys were engaged in a meaningful discussion. It'd be a pleasure to join you whenever it happens.
Yeah, we were actually having fun. We were having fun until you showed up, man.
I know. I was smart. Yeah. With that encouraging note, I'll walk away with my feelings hurt. Yeah. Right.
All right. Good job.
All right, guys. Have a good Shabbat.
Talk to you guys next week.
Okay, bye-bye.
Shalom.
Shalom.